Over and over again, I ask patients what they have to live for. A lot of people have never thought about that. And to me, that's the inner core question of our lives. What are we here for?
Welcome to the Drew Proad Podcast. Each week, we explore the inner workings of the brain and the body with one of the brightest minds in wellness, medicine, and mindset. This week's guest is Dr. Gladys McGarry, the mother of holistic medicine. Dr. Gladys is 102, and she's on our episode today to talk about the 6 secrets that are the key to a well-lived life. Now, a little bit more about Dr. Gladys. She is still a consulting doctor, and by the way, she was seeing patients right up until the age of 86. She's recognized as a pioneer of the allopathic and holistic medical movements. She's also a founding diplomat of the American Board of Holistic Medicine. Dr. Gladys lives and works in Scottsdale, Arizona, where for years she shared a medical practice with her beloved daughter. She currently has a medical consulting practice, maintains a healthy diet, and enjoys a good piece of cake every now and then. She's given talks on major podcasts, been featured in major media outlets like the Today Show, and even has her own TEDx talk, which you can find in the show notes. If you're curious about the keys to longevity, if you're curious about the keys to a well-lived life, today's episode is absolutely for you. Dr. Gladys, welcome to the podcast. I'd love to jump right in. How is your mind so sharp? I've seen your talks. I've seen your interviews. We're here to talk about your 6 longevity secrets, which we'll get to in a second. But let's start off at the beginning. How are you so sharp?
I feel that my work right now is to keep my body healthy and my mind clear. Now, I've done so many things that if I try to redo them at this stage of my life, I could no more, you know, but I can sure go down memory lane, and I can sure recall things that I thought about and really pondered when I was, say, in my 40s. When we started the American Holistic Medical Association, we were so fired up with the concept that we had to bring back the whole inner spirit back into medicine, because what I had been taught in medical school was about the war against disease and pain. That's what
you had mentioned, that, you know, what you were taught in medical school is all about killing, right? Killing bacteria, getting rid of things. It's all about killing and death.
And that's still it. That's the issue that we're still struggling with. But back there, we began to think there has to be something more, you know, And in fact, when we started the American Holistic Medical Association, it took us 2 years to decide how to spell it, because the root word we were looking for was health, healing, and holy. And so connecting the spirit with what we had taught, which was amazing, but not, you know, I was sent to the psychiatrist twice because I kept saying, yeah, but, you know, where is this other aspect, you know? And it was considered, well, I won't even start using the words that when we started the Holistic Medical Association that we were called. We were just weird.
Yeah, totally. You know, and we're going to get into your story, and you have so many fascinating tales that you've written about in your book. I'm going to push back on this question again, genuinely, because I want true answer, in the sense of, I don't want it to be romanticized. Like, obviously talking to you, you're super sharp. You've just written a book. You're very clear. You're very present with me here. And I think that people are looking for a little bit more details beyond what they could see, is that how does your body feel? And I want you to feel comfortable to give the honest truth. I can imagine naturally as we age, there's going to be some things that are going better. There's some things that are going tougher. Our body's not going to be the same as when we were 20 and 30. But I think the big contrast is your book and your message in your life, and just you living on a daily basis, is an example that we don't have to be afraid of death, right? A lot of people say that we don't have to be afraid of getting older. It should not be something that we're afraid of, that we can still function well. So in a genuine sense, if you don't mind me asking, and feel free to say skip if you don't want to answer it, but how does your body feel on a daily basis?
Yeah, I want to talk about it. We really need to be able to live our lives one day at a time. And when you can do that, it's a wow. Today is completely different from yesterday. Yesterday, I went to the ophthalmologist and found out that I had two infusions of stem cells about 2 months ago, and my eyesight has improved to the point where it was better in my right eye than it had been before. Now, to me, I'm almost blind. Well, I'm almost completely blind in the left eye, and my right eye is very much diminished. But the fact that my eyesight isn't so good has done nothing about my insight. It has, in many respects, allowed my insight to improve because there wasn't so much outside for me to concentrate on. When I built this little casita, I had it built with my bedroom on this second floor so that when I got to be older, I would have to go up and down steps. And I'm still going up and down my steps. I kind of have to pull myself up to get up, but I get up and down steps repeatedly during the day. And I use a walker. And a walker is just, I call him Skywalker, because he helps me get around all over the place. And I plan every day to be able to walk 3,800 steps. Now, I don't make it every day, but that's my goal. And so, these are things I can do, and I need help with doing many other things, but my own personal stuff that I have to do personally, I do personally.
This episode is brought to you by AquaTrue. I've talked to so many experts about the importance of clean water as a foundation for great health. And this makes total sense because our bodies are mostly made up of water. So if we don't get enough, our cells literally can't function right. But tap water is no longer an option. Most of it is full of toxins like microbes, pesticides, and plastics, and PFAs. And many of these toxins can cause serious health issues long term. And have you ever heard that cooking off the contaminants from your tap water is a great way to get rid of them? Turns out that contaminants do not boil out. Not cool. When I learned how harmful tap water can be from organizations like EWG, the Environmental Working Group, I started looking for serious solutions. AquaTrue is a countertop reverse osmosis purifier with a 4-stage filtration system that removes 15 times more contaminants than the best-selling water filters that are out there. The one I'm thinking about starts with a B, but I'm not going to say it by name. And AquaTrue is made with BPA and BPS free plastic. And they also recently launched a new glass craft container, which I'm a huge fan of. Right now, AquaTrue is offering my community an amazing deal. Just go to drewperowit.com/filter and get $100 off when you try AquaTrue for yourself today. That's Drew Perowit, DrewPerowit.com/filter and get $100 off when you try AquaTrue for yourself today. This episode is brought to you by Loombox. One of my favorite daily practices is using red light therapy. There are thousands of articles and studies published in PubMed on its efficacy and its ability to improve all sorts of aspects of life, like improving our skin, helping with chronic inflammation. The list goes on and on. Many experts on my podcast, doctors, researchers, have gone into just how powerful red light therapy can be. And one of my favorite ways to get that red light therapy is Loombox. The Loombox is a portable red light therapy device that's FDA registered, and it's super duper affordable. One of my favorite things about Loombox is that they use third-party labs to test the device. And what they found is that their device is 80% more powerful than some of the leading brands that you've heard of. And it meets several safety standards. And it's third-party tested for not having too high levels of EMF, which is huge. And just a reminder for how powerful red light therapy is, it's shown to improve inflammation, wound healing, hair, skin, muscle, and pain recovery. And it's even been shown to stimulate our mitochondria, which are the tiny energy factors that our cells need to survive and thrive, and they're super sensitive to light. I use red light therapy every single night before bed to wind down, true story, and I've noticed huge improvements in my sleep and skin since I started doing it, including less inflammation and less redness. Studies actually show that red light therapy can improve acne, scars, improve wrinkles, fine lines, and collagen production. That's why red light therapy is something I'm committed to, and if you're committed to doing it and you want to step into it, right now is the perfect opportunity to take advantage of this deal from Lumbox. Lumbox is offering my community $260 off their portable red light device. That's over 40% off. All you need is a special link. Just go to theloombox.com/DHRU, Drew, that's me, to get your device and start stimulating your mitochondria today. That's the, T-H-E, loom, L-U-M-E, box.com/DHRU, that's me, to get $260 off this portable red light device that I recommend. What do you credit to the fact that your mind is so sharp? Your ability to explain, I've watched your TED talk, I've heard you on other interviews. How is it that your mind is so sharp? As you know, Alzheimer's disease is one of the scariest diseases for many people, even scarier than cancer. The idea of losing our minds, dementia, cognitive decline. How are you at 102 so sharp?
I have something to live for.
Tell us more about that.
Over and over again, I ask patients what they have to live for. And most, not most, but a lot of people have never thought about that. And to me, that's kind of the inner core question of our lives. What are we here for? And each one of us have a special place. There's nobody else that's in your place or my place or my son's place. We're in this like a jigsaw puzzle where there's one piece that fits and the whole world is the rest of the jigsaw puzzle, but our place is just that place. And we have to touch every aspect of that place. You know, we have to be aware of it and so on. We don't have to, but it's a good thing to try. And in the process, we experience so many things that even if you're having trouble with insomnia, you can do the beautiful thing, which for me is just wonderful, is walk, go down memory lane and recapture some of the amazing things that have happened in my lifetime and my children's lifetime and my great-grandkids. You know, I mean, there's life is so rich and so exciting and so everything else that it's a wow.
You know, there's a lot of people that feel like they're driven by a sense of mission, and yet their body and brain still feels like it's breaking down. So I totally get, and I actually believe wholeheartedly, similar to the idea of man's search for meaning, Viktor Frankl, his message is that having a why is a big and important driver. And it's not just a why, it's like a big audacious why, you know, something that's important to you. What is your why, right? Share that with our audience here. What is your why that has you wake up every morning and feel excited about showing up?
Well, there's always something that needs to be done. I mean, even if it's watering my plants or you know, getting up and doing my steps or whatever. But if you're not looking for something, you don't see it. And so I'm always looking for something that needs to be done. And if I don't get it done, then it doesn't get done that day and I'll have to do it tomorrow. But it's life has to move. You have to have give it some juice to continue to grow within you. If you stop growing, you die. That's what happens. If you think that you aren't worth anything anymore, And if your presence here isn't valued, or it's discounted, or it's a process of just disintegrating, then that's what will happen. It won't happen if you're actually looking for something. If you're looking for the light, if you're reaching for the light will always be there. But if you're not looking for it, it's not going to be there. You might help somebody else if you get it. One of the things that I like to visualize is it's kind of like I've got a flashlight and I'm walking down my path with that flashlight, and all it can do is take me one step further and one step further. But there's that other step and there's that other step. But every so often as I'm walking along, there may be another light on the side that is not quite as bright or as dimmer or a little. But if I shine my light over towards that light, it brightens it up and helps it. So if I'm walking down my path looking for my light and I'm not looking for anybody else's light, it could be kind of boring. But if I'm looking and all of a sudden I see a bright light here, it may just be a little flicker, but what was that, you know? And I can add my light to that. And then you go down a little farther. Oh, there was something else. What was that? There's always something to be looking for. Light's always there. You may not see it, but because you're not looking for it. But if you're looking for it, it's there.
There's also your village.
Oh, yeah. And then there's my 10-year plan, a village for living medicine.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about that? Because what I'm hearing from you is that there's both the short-term tasks, which of course everybody has, and I get the sentiment from you that you have a big drive that makes you feel, I don't have to do these things, I get to do these things. It's a privilege to be able to wake up and water the plants and do these basic tasks. Like, I'm thankful for that. And then there's the long-term why, right? So short-term why, long-term why. So this 10-year plan for a village, talk to us about that. What is it and why do you want to put it together?
Our world feels so disconnected to so many people. They feel like that nobody cares, or who do they care about? It's sort of a sad state for a lot of people. So what I'm dreaming of and what I really am working towards is for Village for Living Medicine, which is for people who want to live their lives and share their lives with other people who want to live their lives and share their lives. And a Village for Living Medicine could happen any place in this world. Sure. I mean, where somebody gets the vision. I have a friend who's Evelyn. She used to live here in Scottsdale, but now she lives in Mexico. And she down there has taken, just sort of moved into the role of being the grandmother for the town. And she has basically created a village for living medicine because everybody knows what everybody's doing around there. And if she needs to go to the doctor comes and picks her up. And if somebody down the street needs a car, she has a car, she goes down and gets the person. You know, it's become a community affair for her. So her life has become so rich that she wakes up for something to do every day.
So that's your vision too, is to try to design an intentional community where people can live, but also live healthy by living the principles of holistic medicine.
Right. They have the garden that they know about. They know the food that they're eating. The air is clear. You know, they are aware that Mother Earth is there too. You know, I have this kind of thought in my mind that has been there a long time, and that is that when God created us, however that happened, he said he gave us humans dominion over the whole world. And we arrogant humans thought that what he was saying was this: I give you dominance over the whole world. So we have taken over the misuse of Mother Earth's gift, which is really our treasure, because we were given the opportunity to love Mother Earth and be loved back again. And we have thought that we got to use her any way we wanted to. And so it's time for us to wake up to who and what she is to us, and we to her.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I want to come back to your story because, again, as I mentioned, you have a super fascinating story. But I've also found that if I share with my audience the tips, suggestions, advice that somebody like yourself has, it and do it early, we really have their attention. So just as you had shared what you think makes your mind super sharp at the age of 102, I'd love for you to get a chance to walk us through these six pillars. You know, from a marketing standpoint, they're called secrets, but really you talk about them in the way that they don't have to be secrets, that are the keys to living a well-lived life. So could you walk us through those?
Well, the first one is we are here for a reason. There's some reason that we got born this lifetime. I happen to think reincarnation makes sense for me, but be that one way or another, it's the idea that I'm here for this reason. And the reason I came up with when I was very young was that my parents were both doctors, and they were both doctors in northern India, and I loved what they were doing. And I decided when I was two that I was a doctor. So my dolls all ended up needing care and all that kind of stuff.
You were following in your parents' footsteps.
Yeah. My sister wouldn't want me to touch her dolls because, you know, I had to fix them. So it was that kind of thing. I came in with the knowledge that I had a purpose. And I believe, truly believe, that each one of us has a purpose. And it's kind of exciting to start looking for what that purpose is. You know, if you aren't looking, you don't find it. But if you're looking for that purpose, you find it. Mm. When I watched my kids, I have six kids. When I watched them growing up, it was so exciting to me to see what it was that they were looking for in their life. Not like my four-year-old came in one day and he looks at me and he says, "Mama, I know something." And I says, "What's that, Bobby?" And he says, "If I make a friend and he makes a friend and he makes a friend, it's going to go all around the world and come back to me." And of course, he's a psychologist, you know. And then there's this one that's with me here. When he was seven, he said to me one day, "I wish Jesus was here." And I said, "Well, I do too, but why you?" And he says, "Because I've got questions." And I said, "Well, try me." He says, "Yeah, but you don't have the answers." And I said, "Well, just try me." So he says, "Okay. How could God be if he never got started?" And I said, "Well, maybe it's like a circle. It doesn't have a beginning and an end." He says, "I knew you didn't have the answer." And so he ran off. So he's been looking for those answers all his life. You know, it's that kind of a awareness that these amazing beings who are being born now and coming into our lives as children and grandchildren and so on, they have a purpose. But it's not just them. It's everybody that you meet is here for a purpose. And if we can look for that purpose within the other person, we may be able to you know, help have them access that purpose within them. Mm. It's like mine listening to my children. It was, I could have said, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, go.
Which a lot of parents do. They say, I have a vision. I'm a doctor. My parents were doctors. You need to become doctors. As you know, that's very common in the South Asian and Indian, you know, background, especially here in America. But what I'm hearing for you is that you're listening to your kids and trying to see what they're naturally interested in, because that's a big guiding light of what their purpose might be.
Yeah. You know, my oldest son is an retired orthopedic surgeon, but he's retired now. He's a master gardener, you know. It's that ability that he came into of working with the earth, with the bones, with the tissues and all of that kind of stuff. He's still doing it, he and his wife. And so it's not something, but you know, and sometimes people have something that they've really wanted to do and they've done it, and then they're done, you know, like they really wanted to be something or other, and they created that, and then they finished that, and they retired, and now what do they do? You know, if they just think, well, it's over, you know, I did everything that I wanted to do. In fact, I have a story about this in the book about a woman who came in, and she was really distraught and felt there was something physically wrong with her because she felt so bad. And when we got right down to it, what she said was, I've done everything I came to do. I have my family and all this. I don't have anything to live for. And it wasn't until we began talking about, she had grandchildren, she had children, she had neighbors, she had a whole a litany of things that she really still had, but she had, in her mind, shut those down and thought, well, I've done that, and that somebody else can do that or something, and gone on. But when she reclaimed those, she lit up and she reignited
her purpose.
Right, and it's not exactly depression. When your purpose is gone, it's something different. It's something, I don't really know quite how to express it, but except that the juice has gone out of your life. The stuff that you really made you happy and wanting to do things is when you have sat down and said, well, it's done, then the body says, oh, okay, I can rest. But the body doesn't understand that when we as physicians say to a patient, well, now you need to go home and rest because you whatever, that doesn't mean that you stop living. But if you accept that as being, okay, that means I don't have anything more to do, and you sit down and you rest, which means you're dead, then you will be, because you have nothing to live for.
It's similar to our muscles. If we don't use them, they atrophy. And what I'm hearing from you, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that we all have a purpose. And even if we achieve a goal, that doesn't mean that we're not still left with some new expression of our purpose in life. This episode is brought to you by Air Doctor. You probably think that the home you're in is pretty safe from air pollution, right? But did you know that indoor air is often 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air? Crazy, I know. Buying new furniture, installing new carpets, painting your living room, and even owning a pet can dramatically affect the air quality inside our homes. Toxins found in polluted air can contribute to everything from cardiovascular disease to neurodegeneration. When I found out how toxic the air in my home could be, I started to use the Air Doctor Professional Air Purifier, and I saw notable improvements in how I felt immediately and when I measured the quality of the air in my home using special devices. Air Doctor has an ultra HEPA filter that's 100 times more effective than any ordinary HEPA filters. Plus, it removes 100% of airborne particles and the vast majority of volatile organic chemicals and gases like formaldehyde and ozone. It's the best home air purifier I've found, and it can be used in any room in the house. Right now, Air Doctor is offering my community $300 off. So just go to drewperowit.com/filter to clean up your home's air quality and feel better today. That's Drew Perowit, DrewPurohit.com/filter to clean up your home's air quality today.
And that there isn't somebody around who really could use something that we have. You know, if we're looking for it, it's something that I can share with my grandchildren or with somebody. Maybe my kids are tired of hearing my stories, but they can hear them again if I choose to tell them again. But it's, you know, it's the ability to really keep things going within yourself so that you can share it with others so that they can get them going within themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like tapping back into your service. I think some people get so confused and caught up in their service because they think and they leave out the part about what does the universe, God, whatever people believe in, what does life, the universe, God want from me? How do you want me to show up? And often our deepest purpose, especially as we get older and older and we've met our household obligations, has to do with something about giving back, even in some small way. Could be teaching, could be a part of our church community, our temple, whatever it is. So I find that when we are so caught up in ourselves and we forget that there's a lot of people out there who would benefit from us just showing up even a little bit, mentoring somebody, being there, visiting an elderly home and spending time with somebody who doesn't have family anymore, that can even be a part of our purpose.
Yeah.
So a question for you, for the people who might be struggling, especially a lot of, you know, young people who are like, I feel like I'm listening, but I'm not getting any clear messages about what my purpose is. Is there anything that you can recommend to them on how they might be able to shake things up or quiet things down so they could better and more appropriately listen?
Well, you know, first of all, if you see, here's one of the things I think is happening in the world, and I'll tie this into what you asked.
Please.
These young men who are going around killing other people, why is that? It's an epidemic in our country.
You mean gun violence and that sort of thing? And just, yeah. You're not talking about video games. You're talking about actual real life violence.
Yes. I'm talking about these young people who are doing that to other people. They're killing, and then killing themselves. I think that maybe one of the things that has happened is that you mentioned the video games and so on. They've watched people come into their lives in their games. They've killed them. They've come back. They've killed them. They've come back. If they have never really experienced death as a loss, loss of a pet, loss of a plant, loss of some family member or something like that, they may not know really what this means to have been really loved enough that you would miss something if it was gone. If you had a dog and that dog died and you really loved that dog, you would know about death. But if you don't, then so they'll come, something will happen. You don't know what it is, but something will happen. I think that if we, instead of using the idea of putting guns in teachers' hands, If we had guardian dogs in our classrooms, we could change that whole thing, because a dog in a classroom, I had a friend who was a teacher, and she said the best year that she had in her class was when she had a dog in the classroom. That dog knew if there was a child that was feeling unloved and all, and that dog would be right there with that child. If there was a child that was afraid of a dog, it wouldn't go near until the child reached out for him. That dog was sensing what was going on in the room all the time, and the children were responding. If these children who don't know anything about true loss of a loving thing or whatever it is that's damaged them to the point where they're going around shooting people, if they had it would be a whole new profession. You'd have to have dogs that are hyperallergenic. They have to be trained. The trainer has to be trained. Teachers have to be trained. The families have to know about it. I mean, it would bring about a wave of love and caring back into a damaged system that doesn't need to be killed and hurt anymore.
So just to make sure I understand, you're saying that not that these dogs would be guard dogs, but that these dogs would be these guardian angels that would be there to support kids, especially kids who just don't have a lot of love in their life. And also, because you come from a holistic background, I mean, there does seem to be, you know, some sort of deep connection with, you know, a lot of these kids are on SSRIs. If we're talking about specifically gun violence in America, obviously there's plenty of kids and young boys that play video games overseas. You know, maybe those countries don't have the same amount of guns that we have in the US, but they also don't seem to have the knife crime that we have or whatever else is there. But, you know, there does seem to be some legitimate concern with processed foods, SSRIs, and these other things that are creating young boys in particular who are already more prone to, you know, being violent because they have bigger bodies. That does seem to be some part of this. Do you feel like those things are part of that too?
Absolutely. It would be interesting to ask if you knew about it beforehand, these young men who are walking down that path, what they eat, what their exercise is, what kind of a life are they living?
Well, and probably not a lot of exercise. We've taken exercise out of school.
I know, and the arts, we've taken the dance, you know, the things that we've taken out of the schools is really sad. We should be having music lessons and all of that back, I think.
Things to bring more connection. But of course, that's a separate conversation itself. So we were going down the list, and you started off with the first one on the list of six secrets to a well-lived life. And that idea was having a strong sense of purpose. What would be the next one that you'd want to go into?
You have to move. Life has to move. And that's the whole process. If you're stuck and you're sitting there and you're not going to move your body, at least move your eyes and start reading. At least do something that gets your body moving. Move your fingers. Start knitting. Do something. But it's the whole, if you stop living, if you stop the actual movement of your body, your heart's going to keep moving and you're going to keep breathing, but it's not going to have anything that it wants to do particularly. So it just gives up and you fade away. You know, it's that kind of a not being engaged with your life. Yeah. You have to move. You have to move your body as well as your mind and your spirit. For my 90th, my 100 and what is it, third birthday, I bought myself a tricycle.
I read about that. Tell us more.
Yeah. When we started the American Holistic Medical Association, we started it because we felt that the spirit was left out of the whole process. Well, when I looked at it, the tricycle, it has the body and it has the mind, but those are the two wheels that make it go like it should go, but you're not going to go any place unless you put the third wheel on in front. So the tricycle says, okay, I'm here to direct where we go and how we go where we go. But that third wheel can't even do anything until somebody gets up on the seat. So when we get up on the seat of the tricycle, we take care of the body, mind, and spirit process that is our life, whatever it is that we're doing. And then we use our bodily energy to make it go. Our mind connects with that and we make it go. So to me, it's an exercise in life's purpose and where what I can do with a day and have a little. Now, there aren't many places I can go because we have a beautiful yard and I can ride around in my yard. And the plants that my son-in-law has planted in the garden, you know, it's an amazing thing.
That's beautiful. And, you know, you mentioned this before earlier in the interview, but you shoot to get 3,800 steps. Now, I think on average, from what I've read from the NIH, the average American, not including, you know, kids, is only getting 4,000 steps. And that's people who are very able-bodied. They're not 102, right? They're in their 20s, 30s, 40s. And here you are, even at the age of 100 plus, you're getting, you know, 3,800 steps. What does that look like for you? Is that a walk inside of the morning? And also, how did you come up with that number, 3,800?
I started with 1,500 and I just increased little by little.
And when did you start with 1,500? At what age were you when you set that goal that you want to do at least 1,500?
I think I was 100.
Okay, got it. And prior to that, how active were you?
You have to realize that decades did telescope for me.
Yes, so, yes, totally. How active were you in your 40s, then 50s, 60s, and 70s? Were you walking on a regular basis? My guess is you were getting a lot more steps back then. So even at 100, getting 1,500 or 3,800 now at 102 is quite a feat. So were you quite active earlier in your life?
Well, I was still practicing medicine until 86. My daughter and I had been in practice together, and we had to change process, and she took on a concierge practice, and I had the opportunity to go to Afghanistan and work with women who were having birthing problems. And my brother had started it was an international organization called Future Generations, which was saying he had started all around the world, really, this Future Generations. And what they had found was that the Afghani women were having a terror, their birth death rate was higher than any place else in the world. And they couldn't find out why. First of all, the husbands wouldn't let them talk, when any men to talk to the wives, but so my brother said, okay, you're retiring, you want to go and do something that might help. So he gave me the opportunity to go with Shukriya Hassan, who was a Afghani woman physician, and with the Future Generations organization, we were able to set up workshops so that Afghani women could come and learn about what I'm calling loving birth. And what it turned, when we first started, we said we want them to come, and the husband said no, because we had to ask the men, of course. And they said, no, you can have our wives. We said, okay. Shukriya said, we want your mothers-in-law. Oh, well, that's okay. You could have our mothers-in-law. So exactly the women we wanted, because they were the ones who'd had the babies. So we had these workshops and were able to teach them about what was going on because within their bodies, because as far as they were concerned, they knew how they conceived these babies, but what went on in there, they had no idea. It was like, how do I know what's going on in my stomach right now? You know, it was
right. They were undereducated on the birthing process, which was part of the thing that contributed to the high death rate.
Right.
For mortality.
No, that wasn't what contributed.
Oh, it didn't. Okay. My apologies.
It was partly, but what we found out was because we had them, each one of them tell us their stories for each birth. We found out that when they got pregnant, they were told not to eat anything that had calcium in it, which was yogurt and eggs and carrots and so on. So they were, when they talked about giving birth, they talked about this in labor. Well, that's hypocalcemic tetany. So that was one thing. But then when they started labor, they weren't given anything to eat or drink because, I don't know why, because. But then
was there a religious thing? They were some sort of superstition?
We asked them and they said some man must have thought it up. They had no answer. Then what happened? They were totally unable to push the baby out, and somebody from the outside had to push that baby out. Mm. So what you had was prolapsed uterus, bladder, just all death, just everything. You know, it was just terrible. And they just didn't know how the baby got out because the only way they know of this is to push it out from the outside. And so when we told them about how the cervix had to open up and they got it.
Wow.
There were 35 women at each one of these things, and they would go back to their villages, and they taught their, because women, when they learn something, they teach it. It's inherent in us. They went home, they taught, and the death rate was cut in half almost. You know, I don't know what the statistics are now, but Afghanistan is not the worst in the world. No.
Right. Well, going back to your larger idea, because, you know, this number two was all about movement. You were really teaching these women who were then teaching the husbands in society how the woman's body is designed to move and as part of the birthing process. And what an amazing feat, you know, even if there was one life that was saved, and obviously there was many more, how beautiful that you guys were able to do that and contribute to that society.
But let me take you back to when I was in medical school and we learned about birthing. We learned how to put forceps on in order to deliver babies because our purpose was, according to the medicine at that time, women didn't want to feel the pain. Well, I think it's the men didn't want to hear the pain, but that's all right. They didn't want to feel the pain, so we gave them what we called twilight sleep, and they were totally anesthetized. For my two first births, I was told I didn't know I had what I had for 24 hours. I mean, that's how deep was the anesthesia. But we, as physicians, learned how to do what the Afghani women were trying to do, but we went and put forceps on. And I was really good at applying the force. I could get after coming head and do a good delivery. But now I've realized that what we have done with that process in our psyche, our way of thinking of things, is we've totally allowed our women, our lives, to understand that they have to be delivered of babies. Mm. I'm starved. I'm saying we deliver pizzas, we deliver speeches. We don't deliver babies. Mothers birth babies. And so my mission here also is to bring back the loving birth concept that this the pain during labor is something that when you actually have experienced that and lived through it, it's not the tetany that the Afghani women had or the horror that is conjured up if you try to concentrate on the pain. I had one patient who actually danced her baby out. It was the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen. She was a dancer, and she actually was able to move her body as with dance steps. And I was there to help her catch the baby, but she's the one who delivered it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And of course, we're so thankful for modern medicine and all the different things that it brings in. But what we're really talking about here is we've become so disconnected. And there is a very good conversation that's happening about the negative consequences. You know, even my older sister, who's not a doula or anything like that, but is a big advocate because of her pregnancy and process of delivering, she is educating my cousins all the time that is like, okay, look, sometimes people need, you know, pain medication and they feel that, but just be aware there's always consequences. You might be more likely to tear in the birthing process. It might be harder to recover. That's there. So just reconnecting people with the true consequences of going down a particular path, not putting, you know, blame on anybody who chooses any decision, even if that's C-section, but understanding that, okay, there could be trade-offs that are there and we should be aware because some trade-offs could cause more disconnection.
Right. And it's calling, I'm calling it loving birth.
Loving birth. That's beautiful.
No matter what the technique is, if it's done with the concept that this is the mother's choice, the mother's ability, the mother's and the baby connection to be able to birth that baby lovingly, because the baby's involved too.
Yeah, how many women were basically semi-pressured into getting a C-section simply because their doctor had a golf trip the next day and didn't want to miss it and then pressured the person into that situation? Or, you know, there's a lot of things that go into the whole, I believe there's a few documentaries on it. One that Ricky Lake was involved with as well too. So,
absolutely.
You know, I want to ask you a question. You know, I've read about your parents from a young age. They took you to India. You were, you know, raised there. They were practicing in sort of the jungles of India with these different communities. They were osteopathic doctors. Before we talk a little bit more about their story, and feel free to weave in stories about them as we go through the rest of these six, we've done two so far. But tell me a little bit, as we're talking about you being 102 years old, how long did your parents live? Because I think sometimes people are wondering, does this amazing doctor who's lived a beautiful life, there's no denying that she's lived an incredible life, but is part of the reason that she got to 102, is that her genetic lineage?
Well, my parents were both in their late 90s to die, when they died, or the mid-90s, 96.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but they had lived their life with purpose and so on, you know. They always had...
They practiced a lot of the principles that you're talking about here, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yes, maybe genetics load the gun, but lifestyle and a well-lived life and purpose and community and moving are the things that pull the trigger so that the bullet, this is a bad analogy, can go as far as it can go, right? So that you have the greatest potential that's there.
Well, the third secret is love is the great healer.
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, because if... You know, it wasn't too long ago I had a conversation with one of the hospital chiefs here because we were talking about this stuff. And he said, well, how do we, in the hospital, incorporate some of these other modalities, which you call holistic, call them what you want to? And I said, well, you know, I don't think it's the modality. I don't think it, whether you're a chiropractor or an osteopath or a MD, that is there, and you accept that, but the way in which it is done is what's important. If it's done with love and caring and understanding, and the and the patient is involved with it, then you can use any one of these modalities. You know, my eldest son was an orthopedic surgeon, but when he came through Phoenix, he came ready to start his practice in Del Rio, Texas. He said to me, "Mom, I'm real scared. I have this amazing training. I'm going into the world. I'm going to have people's lives in my hands. I don't know if I can handle that." Hmm. And I said, "Well, Carl, if you think you're the one that does the healing, you have a right to be scared. But if you can understand that it's your job to do this amazing work, which is orthopedic surgery, we really need it. You need to know how to do that the very best that you can do, and then support the patient as the physician within them takes over the healing process. You support that process, which now you turn over to the person who is actually doing the healing."
Yeah, that's beautiful. It's a reminder of the body's inner ability under the right conditions and circumstances to create healing within itself, restore the body's natural ability to heal itself.
Right. It's my physician, I as a physician, honor the physician within you.
Yeah.
As a colleague.
For sure. For sure. While you're going through these six, and we have three more to go, I'm going to splice in some questions that are common questions that I know, you know, because I've seen your other lectures. I see your YouTube comments. I see people are very motivated by your story, and they also genuinely have questions too. So one of the questions that people have is, well, because Dr. Gladys is also a physician and she has happened to coach and treat people over the years, as you mentioned, you were practicing up until 86, which amazing. And now even still, I believe you say that you do consults with people. You're not practicing medicine, but you do consults. So they want to know, what is your approach when it comes to diet? And one of the things that you've said is that people have to figure out what works for themselves. Now, that being said, are there still bigger picture principles that you think that if you were the head of, you know, the National Institute of Health, or if you were the head of, you know, the FDA, and they were looking to you, you were the Surgeon General of the United States, and they're looking for big picture principles that people would benefit from and potentially even live longer if they followed, would there be anything that you would suggest?
Sure. I mean, drink lots of water. Get your vegetables as fresh as you can, as alive as you can. Use meat that agrees with you. If it doesn't, you know, don't eat it. Just because somebody says that lamb is good for everybody, I don't agree with that. You know, it's good for a lot of people, but not for... So find out what works for you. I have a son who really doesn't like onions and garlic. Now, the rest of the family loves onions, garlic. We grew up in India. We understand. But he gets abdominal pain and so on. So find out what works for you. And then make it as... whatever, you know, there's some people who actually are in situations where they can't get the kind of food that they would like. But if they look for it, they probably can. And the food is alive and well, you can't be eating live food much unless, you know, but you want the essence
of vibrancy, the essence of life.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. You want the essence of life in the food that you eat.
Yes. You know, you mentioned a gentleman's name, and I was just curious, you know, we don't have to go into it if you don't want to, but it sounded like you were talking about, somebody was asking about the Mediterranean diet, and you were saying, you know, it sounds like you were influenced a little bit by the work of Edgar Cayce. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Would you feel comfortable talking about that and telling our audience who this individual was?
No. Edgar Cayce in the 50s there was a book written called There is a River, and he was a psychic in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and he gave readings for people, and these readings...
He was a clairvoyant.
Yeah, right. And gave... and in his way of speaking about this, he said that people would ask about, you know, they'd write him a letter and ask for help. And he said when he lay down to move into this state of unconsciousness that he would move into, he said his spirit would contact the spirit of the person asking the question, and they would go to the Akashic records and get the answers, and he would bring them back and give them to the patient. Well, you know, he called it my spirit bearing witness with thy spirit. It was that kind of thing. But the things that he started talking about really gave us something to work with. My husband was a physician too. And so we joined the ARE and actually created the ARE clinic in Phoenix. And that's where so many of the holistic things back in the 70s took, you know, we had students coming and so on. It was an amazingly active group of people doing things. It's how we started with acupuncture and so on. So it was a Edgar Cayce was the spark that lit the light that we followed then and worked with, and still it's very important to me.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I mean, it sounds like he was a little bit ahead of his times. I haven't studied him. I had barely looked him up before this interview because I was preparing, and I'd written his name down as somebody who was an influence in your life. But he also had a, you know, ahead of his time in terms of dietary approach, right? And it sounds like he's been a little bit of an influence on your diet. And could you explain kind of his diet big picture? It seems like he was really big on getting people away from eating a lot of like refined grains and things like that, fried food.
Cutting back on that. He didn't like pork very much. He, you know, he's stay away from that. And as again, what I had said, as alive as possible, the food that you eat. And always, always bless your food. Because that was a secret that is, I think, so important. Because that third secret is that love is the great healer. Mm. And if you accept that love is the great healer, you're asking for the loving universe to bless the food that you're eating or whatever, however you want to do it. But it's that just basically being able to say thank you for this food and then have your food something that you want to be thankful for.
Absolutely. And setting that vibration inside of you of even if people don't believe in vibration, anything else, whatever, even just removing that sense of fight or flight and going into rest and relax and digest, right? Gratitude has a tendency to do that, and blessing our meal or saying thank you or a prayer or just even a little moment of gratitude. Sometimes people close their eyes and just have a quick little moment of gratitude, which sort of sets the intention for I'm ready to receive. Amazing. I love that. So thank you for sharing that with us. Let's go on to the next principle. You know, you covered the first three. The last one was love heals all. You talked about the power of movement. You talked about having a purpose. What's the next one that you want to go into?
You're not alone. Mm. We're not alone. We're all in this together. And when you really can accept that, life becomes really, really rich. So, you know, you step into the world of other people and you're looking outside of yourself. You know, and that's it's just a really good thing to understand.
Yeah. What were some of your early experiences, especially maybe growing up in India, about realizing the power of community, leaning on people, and the power of not being isolated. Do you have any stories or early memories?
Do I? My first 2 years were in school, Woodstock School up in the Himalayas in Landar, Missouri, and it was a wonderful school and all that.
The name of the school was Woodstock?
Was Woodstock. Still wow. There. Still, you know.
It's started still, by Americans or started by Indians?
It was started 200 years before I got there by the people who were missionaries who came out and were wanting their children educated. So it started as a small school, but it grew into that. Anyway, up until that time, my life was bliss. But when I started school, I found out that I couldn't read or write. I was so dyslexic that the letters and numbers were all over the place. And so I was the class dummy. The teacher there, she really didn't like me. She thought I was stupid. She told me I was stupid. She told the other students I was stupid. So the kids fought with me and they called me stupid and I punched them out and got into trouble and all of that kind of stuff. So school for 2 years, and I had to repeat first grade because I really couldn't read or write. Yeah. And so at the end of the day, when I was finished with school, I had to climb up because our home was 1,000 feet above. This is the Himalayas. And mile down, 1,000 feet up. So I had to climb up that. And that was fine because I had time to really, really, really feel bad. And when I got to the top of the hill, my Aya, who was like my second mother, was there waiting for me. And she had her chadar around her. And she would hold her arm
like a shawl,
out like this.
Like a shawl for people who don't know the term chadar.
And she'd hold her chadar out like this and she'd say, Idrao, come here. And I'd go over and climb in under her arm and my world would come back to life. And I could go on so that I'd go back the next day. And then the third year in school, I had a teacher who saw something in me that the other one had not seen. And she appointed me class governor. Well, you know, India was under British rule and we had governors and all. So I was class governor because she saw that I could do things that others weren't interested in doing or something. I don't know. But so that was my job. And it was my job then to take a report to the whole student body. And I could do that. I could talk. You know, but I couldn't read or write, but I could talk. And so there's a wonderful story here because it's a big principle. So this one time, because I was taller than anybody else, because I'd had an extra year, we had a play that we were to do for the whole student body, and it was called The Frog Jumped Over the Pool. Well, I was the frog, and my mother made me a green frog outfit, and so I walked out on the stage with a lot of confidence. But I saw my two older brothers in the first row in the auditorium, and it threw me off my step so enough that instead of jumping over the pool, I landed in it. So I'm standing in this dishpan of water, and I start to cry because I'm so humiliated by what I've done here, and I can't move. I can't even get up or down or anything. And of course, my suit is beginning to fade. You know, this kacha dye, and it was fading into the. So I'm standing there crying until the teacher comes in. Takes me off the stage. So at dinner time that night, we're at the table and my brothers are telling how totally hysterical this was. Everybody was laughing and so on. So my mother listened to that whole story that they were telling. And then she said to them, "All right now, boys, you've had your fun. What can we as a family do to help Gladys so that if she gets into this kind of trouble in her life from here on, she'll be able to get people to laugh with her and not at her?"
Yeah.
And it's been a transformative thing for me, because there are lots of times I'll trip and, you know, fall and things will happen. But I can always use that moment to get the audience collected. And then we go on with my talks. So it's that whole idea that the next secret is everything is a teacher. And if we could really use that as teaching things, like my mother was so able to do, it's transformative.
Absolutely. And, you know, I really resonated with that story, because when I was younger, I also had dyslexia as well. It was more of a mild case, you know, compared to what you were sharing about your story. And then as I got older, I realized that dyslexia and a lot of the research that's gone into it, I don't know if you know this statistic, you've talked about it too, in terms of how you met up with other group of doctors who are also dyslexic, but something like 60% of Fortune 500 CEOs have some case of dyslexia. And the thought process is, in these analyses that have been done by places like Harvard Business Review, is that when you have a challenge or a learning disability like dyslexia, it puts you in a position where you get really good at getting other people to help you with things. You're not afraid to ask, or you are used to collaborating with other people because you need to get their help to accomplish the task. And today, as a CEO, small business, not Fortune 500, but still a team of, you know, 60 plus people, those skill sets of being able to lean in and ask people, I don't know if I would have developed them if I didn't have that learning challenge as a child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's powerful. That's a really powerful story. Oh, sorry. Were you going to say something else?
The fact that when we started the HMA and we were sitting around the table, there were 10 of us and 6 of us were dyslexic.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something there, right? Not that we want people to induce dyslexia amongst their kids, but there's definitely something that's there in terms of leadership, seeing things differently. In fact, that's one of the things I remember you saying, is that dyslexia and you kind of being in both worlds, but, you know, even you being, you know, a Westerner who was growing up in India, you had your feet in both worlds. It caused you to have a different perspective and question things, have a different outlook on items, which is a big reason why you pursued the path that you did and got into holistic medicine. And now we're 102 years old, still teaching people about how to live a well life.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the next item here, as we are, I've kept you here for an hour and 10 minutes. Let's go to the last couple secrets of a well-lived life that are here. So the last one that you, actually you just kind of previewed it a little bit. Can you share a little bit more about what it was?
Yeah, that everything is a teacher.
Everything is a teacher. Great.
Yeah.
So do you feel like you have anything more to add to that, or would you like to go to the next one?
No, let's go to the next one.
Okay, let's go to it.
You want to share your juice wildly. You want to use it wildly, not wisely. And
wildly. Share your juice wildly.
You can't store it. You can't bank it. You can't put it in a box and keep it so it'll be an antique, you know. It's your juice is alive and moving, and the only way it can be kept that way is to keep it moving. So it's, you see something, you go for it. You don't just sit back and contemplate it. You can do that, but then you have to move. And so it's.
And when you talk about juice, just to interrupt for a second, is that what our vigor, our liveliness, our gratitude, you know, what is our juice?
It's what that core of us. And I just found out, I was doing a lecture for my son, who's a psychologist, and he had the next person that spoke. Oh, my son had said, we come from a weird family. And so the next person that spoke said, let me tell you what I think the word weird means. She said, my family is Welsh. And people, when they came met each other in the morning, they wouldn't say good morning. They would say, how's your weird? And the weird was that inner core within each person that was either strong or weak. And if you weren't feeling well, it's my weird isn't, very good. But yeah, fine, my weird is strong. It's that ability to accept the fact that maybe the thing that makes you different is the thing that is really helping you to see that it's different and that other people are different. And wow, is that a wow?
Mm. It's that unique essence that makes you who you are.
Right.
And we're all weird in our own way. And it's when we try to become normal that we suppress that weirdness. There's a financial author. His name is Dave Ramsey. I followed his program many, many years ago when I was just getting out of university or dropping out of university rather. And he says, normal is broke, be weird, save money, plan for your future, do all these things that make you weird in the eyes of others, but you don't want to be normal because normal is broke. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't have savings and it's a sad situation. There's a lot of things that contribute to it, but same thing could be applied to the world of health. Normal is fat, sick, overweight, chronic health issues, all these problems. That's normal. That's what we look at in the world and we see normal. We want to be a little bit weird, which gives us a different perspective and approach in life.
Right. Right.
Well, that's beautiful. I love that. You have to share the story of your encounter as we're sharing stories here, as you're sharing stories here. Tell us about how you met Gandhiji in your journey.
Well, it was fascinating because I was 10 years old and we were in the process of coming back to the States. Every 7.5 years, my parents had a furlough. So we came back to the States. But we were on the train going to Bombay, from Roorkee to Bombay. And there was the train slowed down at one of the stations and there were huge crowds. Of course, there are always crowds in India, but this was kind of an organized crowd and they were chanting and so on. And I had my face placed, I was just looking through the window to see what all this was about. And there I saw Gandhiji with his dhoti and his lartik walking along. And
his stick and his loin, for those people that don't know those words.
And he reached down and took a flower from a little girl who was reaching up. And as he looked up, he looked straight into my eyes. And it's one of those things that you can't explain in words, but there was a connection. And I felt that connection just very deeply. It was like, whoa, I still can feel the kind of the jolt and how important that was. But the interesting thing that goes on with this is that 30 years later, I guess it was, when the partition happened in India, my parents worked with Gandhi in the partition. They took their medical team and helped to bury people and work with people. It was a terrible time in India. The Hindus and the Muhammadans it was just really, really bad.
A lot of violence. It's one of the largest migrations in history. Just a because lot of heartbreak.
They were disrupted. They had to leave their home and go into another part.
Right. It was very messy.
And it was so. And I have here a shawl that Gandhi gave my mother. So I have it right here. I could, And he gave my dad a Panipat dog blanket. So it was that kind of an intimate relationship. After I had that deep connection with Gandhi as a 10-year-old.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful story. Dr. Gladys, as we are wrapping up here and people are reflecting on their life, I think that sometimes what I see is that it can be very powerful for individuals to meditate on what didn't go well. You know, there's always maybe friction or miscommunication or a friendship that there was a fight and you lost touch with them and you want to, you know, heal it. And one of my favorite books is this book called The Five Regrets. The Five Regrets. And it's a book by Bronnie Ware, who was a nurse that was working in hospice care, and I believe it was in Australia, and she went to individuals who had, you know, a week, 5 days, 2 weeks left to live, and she started documenting out what their top, you know, regrets were. Now, you've lived a well-lived life, and that's what your book is about. Are there any regrets that you have or things that you might do differently, or do you not even look at it that way?
I don't want to spend a lot of time on my regrets. I have regrets, you know, everybody does. But what I found out was that my life became much more livable and interesting when I accepted the regrets and went on to what I chose to what I call memory lane. The memories that I want to really work with are the memories that helped me and helped other people and brought light more, and instead of the dark places. The dark places, they can kind of overcome what you're trying to, what I'm trying to do, because there, you know, there are dark places. They're really painful places, and I can. It's like sort of having a cut on your arm, and it forms a scab, and you sit there and pick at the scab. It won't ever heal, but if you let it
keep on revisiting it, and you keep on bringing up that pain.
Right. If you let it heal, you can look back and say, "Oh, hello, I know who you are." You know, it's that kind of a acceptance of what you lived through, because you healed that aspect, and you healed it because you chose to heal it, not because you chose to keep picking at it.
I like that word, acceptance. It's a reminder that it's, and I think it's a balance that's there. The more that you live a well-lived life, which are the principles that you're talking about, the less likelihood that you're going to have these big regrets that, you know, Bronnie Ware talks in the book, The Five Regrets of the Dying. And that's the beautiful part. The challenging part for a lot of people is that if they don't meditate a little bit on at least some big regrets, they could end up being, you know, 60, 70, 80, maybe even 100 years old and feel like they didn't live the life that they were meant to live. That's not you, right? But that can be other people that are there. But
I have the scars and I know what they are.
Right. As you mentioned, because everybody does have regrets. But the regrets in this book, which are really interesting, one of the top regrets was, I wish I lived the life that I was meant to live instead of the life that others wanted me to live. My guess is that's not one of your tiny regrets, right? You fully look like you've lived the life that you wanted to live.
Yes, I have.
Another regret that's there is that people regret spending too much time working and not enough time with family, right? Yeah. Is that anything that you feel?
No, because I was able to integrate the family with my work. It was like when Bill was in the service, it was the Korean War, and I had the whole town to myself. I would come home so tired, and my son, who was 18 months old, would be sitting on the front steps. And I'd pick him up and take him in and he'd sit in the rocking chair and he'd pat my shoulder. And it was sort of a replay of when the ayah called me in, you know. It was that replay. And he would pat me on the shoulder until he fell asleep. and I was able to put him to bed. But it was, I had that to look forward to, a simple thing like that that connected the juice that was there, which was my family, with the juice that was there, which was the patients.
That's beautiful. As somebody who works with both the sisters and my dad, even though he's semi-retired, is also helping me with one of my companies. That's, I feel like I won the lottery with my family. And the whole reason I got involved in entrepreneurship was so I could stay closer to my family and then hire them and get a chance to work with them on projects. So I love that you did that in your life. Can I give you just a couple more regrets that are there so that you can put your spin? Again, these are regrets of people that didn't live a well-lived life. So the next regret that somebody had was, that a lot of people had, was, I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. As somebody who's so sharp, well-communicative, I'm guessing that that's not a regret that you've had in your life.
No, because I had figured out when I was dyslexic that I had to fight for things. And so I did. And that got me into trouble, too. Even that, expressing myself, got me, you know, it didn't get me what I thought it was going to. And I had to lived through that process too. So, yeah.
Yeah, it might have gotten you in trouble, but it made you a strong woman, punching all those kids in the first grade. Well, the last one that I'll jump to is the regret that a lot of the dying had in Bronnie's book, which is, I wish I had let myself be happier. Again, not a regret that I see you having.
No, I my mother named me Gladys and called me Gladdy. And I have been very grateful for that name, because it reminds me that my mission is being glad. In fact, that's why I put my license plate on, you know, be glad.
Mm. I love that. It was baked into your destiny with the namesake that was given to you. Dr. Gladys, this has been fantastic. Your book is a great read, and we have a link to it inside of the show notes, The Well-Lived Life, 102-Year-Old Doctor's Six Secrets to Health and Happiness at Every Age. Are there any final words that you want to leave our audience with before we conclude here tonight?
Yes, I'm so amazed that I'm still alive and have this to say, you know? I mean, to me, life is that awesome that here I am and I'm talking to you, and you were from India and I was, you know, all of this kind of connection.
We have a lot of parallels in our story. Yes.
Right. It could never have happened, but it did.
Yeah. That's one of the bright sides of technology. If it wasn't for the internet, if it wasn't for Amazon, if it wasn't for social media, I wouldn't have known about your story. And so while social media and the internet gets a lot of negativity, there's a lot of positivity that's in there too. And this conversation is one of those examples. Hey, I want to ask you a favor. Can you tell me your birthday? I'd love to add it to my calendar so that I can wish you happy birthday over the next 10 years as you're on your path to build this village. What's your birthday?
November 30th, 1920.
Okay. And for all those that are, you know, since we have a lot of women that listen to this podcast, not to stereotype here, but I've typically found that women are more into astrology than men. And obviously you're from India, where having an astrologer is like having a dentist. Everybody has, you know, an astrologer. What sign does that make you?
Sagittarian.
Sagittarius. Amazing. Just like both of my sisters. Well, Gladys, I've added your birthday to my calendar. I'm excited to wish you happy birthday this year. And I thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing your secrets. And they're only secrets because even though they make complete sense when you hear them, they're not practiced as much. And you're reminding us about the importance of practicing them in our life if we want a well-lived life. So thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Drew here. Two quick things. Number one, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you haven't already subscribed, just hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. And by the way, if you love this episode, it would mean the world to me. And it's the number one thing that you can do to support this podcast is share it with a friend. Share it with a friend who would benefit from listening. Number two, before I go, I just had to tell you about something that I've been working on that I'm super excited about. It's my weekly newsletter, and it's called Try This. every Friday, yes, every Friday, 52 weeks a year, I send out an easy-to-digest protocol of simple steps that you or anyone you love can follow to optimize your own health. We cover everything from nutrition to mindset to metabolic health, sleep, community, longevity, and so much more. If you want to get on this email list, which is, by the way, free, and get my weekly step-by-step protocols for whole body health and optimization, click the link in the show notes that's called Try This, or just go to drewperowhit.com. That's DrewPurohit.com, and click on the tab that says Try This.